On today's episode, Blake Snell goes down, but Ian Happ comes up. Can the Rays' touted young starter finally find a way to corral his command? Can the Cubs handle another good young hitter, or will they eventually have to deal someone for a pitcher? Plus, the guys go over the Mets' continued injury issues, Jose Berrios and Aaron Sanchez come back, and much, much more. It's the DFA Podcast. Welcome to Episode 6 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grosnick of BP, and joining me, as always, is my co-host RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, how did you celebrate Jeter Week this weekend?
I worked, Brian.
But you worked in a Jeter-esque fashion, I hope. You know, kept your head down, grinded it out, and I don't know, had trouble on balls to your left.
Correct, but I also have double on balls to my right, so I'm an equal opportunity seeing a single individual. So,
did you watch any of the ceremonies or anything?
I pitched in with CBS's coverage of it. So, you know, Derek Jeter's nephew tipping his hat was probably the highlight for me. And there are a lot of photos of him tipping his hat, especially recently, at all these Jeter-centric events. And you know, the kid is a big league quality doffer, so you have to give him that, and hopefully it comes in handy for him down the road.
Yeah, that would be great. We want to see that on the highest stage of baseball once again. That'd be excellent. I think it's nice to see Bernie Williams once again. Like that, like yeah. It seems like he's been kind of cut out of the Yankees, like kind of discussion of these great teams recently. He seems like almost kind of like the forgotten guy out of the big four sometimes. So I like seeing him every time he comes around.
Right. I think you had, I wasn't specifically you, but I think there were definitely arguments that he was a more deserving member of the core four or what have you than he gets credit for. But yeah, good to see Bernie. It was good to see Hideki Matsui too.
Oh, that guy's so weird.
Well, geez, very fond of you. So
no, I mean, he's just kind of a fun, funny guy. I feel like he's just kind of out there and a very distinctive among the Yankees greats, which is, it's fun to see him around.
He has that aura to him. You know, you can just tell, he can play ball. You know, he could hit. Yeah. There's that professional aura, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Very much a superstar.
Exactly.
So, do you know who's not a superstar? That's my transition into our big move for the day. It's talking about a guy who's not a superstar at all, though he was projected to be a little bit better than he's turned out to be. The big move for today is the Rays sending down left-handed pitcher and one-time top prospect Blake Snell. Snell has not been good this year. I don't know if that might be an understatement. He's been pretty bad this year. He's never really come into his own as the kind of fireballing left-handed starter that he was expected to be. And now the Rays are sending him down to Durham to get some work in. RJ, as our resident Rays expert and former fan, tell me a little bit about Blake Snell and if you can figure it out, what's went wrong for him so far in his MLB career.
He's been really bad. If you look at his numbers, he's taken a step back basically every way he can this season compared to last. And I know it's a small sample size, but let me just point this out. He's made 8 starts this season. He went 6 2/3 innings in his first start, and in the 7th since, he has not worked into the 7th inning. These last 3 times out, he's recorded at least 105 pitches in each game. He has 15 2/3 innings to show for. So he's been just impossibly inefficient. And if you look at some of his other numbers, his strike percentage has went from 60.4% down to 56.9%. Well, the league average is 63.7%. So he's not throwing his pitches for strikes. He's getting into these large, you know, inefficient innings where he's wasting a ton of pitches. And, you know, the weirdest thing to me, and this is, again, just number diving, when there's a man on base this season, he's allowed a 702 OPS, and he has a 1.5 – 0.56 strikeout to walk ratio. Okay. When there's nobody on base, he's allowed an 857 OPS and he has a 1.25 strikeout to walk ratio. Like, that doesn't even make sense. And again, it's a small sample. We're talking about 100 plate appearances each way, but he's got to go down. He's got to find some semblance of command. And, you know, maybe he should just start working from the stretch. I don't know, but he's been a really big disappointment. And I'm trying to think, like, who was the last highly touted Rays prospect on the pitching side, at least, who came up, spent this much time in the majors and then was sent down for more than like a procedural move? Like, Jeremy Hellickson got sent down a few years ago, but it was at the end of the season and it was really just to expand their roster. This is the first time I can remember in quite a while that they've actually sent someone down after they've came up and kind of established themselves.
Yeah, I'm trying to think to myself. I don't remember Wade Davis ever getting sent down when he was struggling.
No, he signed that extension, I think, before his first full spring or his second full spring, and he was locked in from there. Maybe Jason Hamill?
Yeah, maybe. I don't think they ever sent down Jeff Niemann. I mean, the big NyQuil. I'm not sure. I'm trying to think. I don't think Sonnenstein ever had much time, and now we're getting really back there.
Yeah, and they weren't as highly – well, Niemann was highly touted. Yeah, otherwise, I mean, this is the first time in a long time, so far as I can remember. We're talking 10 years here that they have had a highly touted pitching prospect come up and fail to this extent, get sent back down to Durham. And there have been some comments about, you know, how Snell's kind of, I guess, laissez-faire attitude towards his struggles rubbed the team the wrong way. So there's some red flags, I guess you could say, around his demotion that go beyond his performance. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how that works out. There's really nothing positive you can say here other than he's still young, he's still talented, you know, the pedigree is there. You know, he had seemingly three good pitches. When he first came up, that debut against the Yankees, he looked like he was the real deal. He was mixing his pitches. He was locating. He looked like he was more polished at that point in his career than David Price or Matt Moore were. And I don't know. It's been all downhill from there. And it's really a rough situation for a Rays team that didn't need another rough situation.
Yeah, the command really does seem to be the issue because he's got movement, he's got velocity. It's really more of a command and an inefficiency issue. That last start that he had, he threw 113 pitches, which is as much as really any starting pitcher has thrown in any game this year, which is crazy to think for a guy who's a really young still prospect, that the Rays of all teams would let a guy throw 113 pitches. But he just can't seem to avoid it. He just can't be efficient. He's not really a pitch-to-contact guy. You know, his ground ball rate's horrible. He's a fly ball pitcher. It's just that this year, I mean, he's been so bad. And, like, the ERA doesn't even tell the full story. It's above five, but he had a number of unearned runs, especially at the beginning of the season. He's getting some strikeouts, but the strikeout rates are way down, but probably because he can't get ahead of hitters, I would have to imagine. I mean, that's got to be a big thing. So the command is going to be an issue for strikeout rate as well.
Yeah, and you're right. He's up constantly with his fastball. And then when he throws the secondary pitches, it's usually below the zone. And, you know, I guess I was talking with Mike Exceeds about this, and he pointed out that it took like 400 innings for Clayton Kershaw's walk rate to go from like four or whatever, dip underneath that four mark, I guess I would say. And maybe we'll see that with Snell. But Kershaw was a few years younger than Snell at that time, so it's not like a great comparison beyond young lefty who was a top prospect. I don't know. This is miserable if you're a Rays fan because, again, they were counting on him to sort of ascend and be, if not the new face of this rotation, at least, you know, the second best starter alongside Archer. Now they are without that, and it's just not a pretty looking rotation to me. Like, Matt Andrees has been good. Jake Odorizzi is like a constant trade target. He's probably going to get dealt before the year is out. Same with Alex Cobb. They have some young arms coming through the system, but right now they're looking at potentially starting Erasmo Ramirez or Chase Whitley or, I don't know, digging. I don't think they're going to dig into the AAA rotation here and bring up anyone we'd really want to see.
Right.
Maybe. And I would note that the corresponding move here was bringing up Ryan Stanek, and that one might actually have some long-term ramifications because their bullpen is bad. I mean,
yeah.
they have, you know, when you're using Jumbo Diaz in high leverage situations, you have issues. And Stanek, for those who didn't know, he was one of their first round picks in 2013. There were Daniel Bard comparisons on him then, although he was a starting pitcher, which if you're a starting pitcher, you don't want a Daniel Bard comparison. But if you're a reliever, a Daniel Bard comparison was pretty good, you know, once upon a time. So he's fastball slider. His walk rate has really been sliced into this season. If he can throw strikes, you know, he's got a chance to be a setup man type. We'll see. But the Rays could really use some promising relievers. I know they have Jose Alvarado up. He still has some of the same issues there, though. Good fastball velocity. It's unclear if he can command it enough, though, to reach his ceiling.
Well, Alvarado, who's the only lefty in the Rays pen right now, I mean, he topped out at high A last year. I mean, this is not a guy he's on the fast track to the major leagues, but he's not a top prospect, and he's certainly, you know, despite his fastball, he's not a guy who you think is going to be a top end reliever, I would think, at this point.
Yeah, but I would know the reason he's not a top prospect isn't because of his stuff. It's because, I mean, let's just get the exact walk right here for a second. It's because last season, okay, year which he topped out at Double A, he threw 80 innings. He walked 6.6 per nine. So, you know, when you have that kind of stuff and you're not even getting, you know, the high A guys to chase outside of the zone, yeah, that's going to keep you off the prospect list. But to his credit, in 11 innings in Double A, he only walked 4 per 9. And so far in his major league career, 5 innings, he hasn't allowed a walk. Of course, he hasn't struck anyone out, really.
Also, you know, got a 5 ERA. So
True. I was trying to look at the bright side here. Give Jose Alvarado some love.
I mean, you know, he's struck out one guy in five and a third, and yeah, it's you know, I'm certainly rooting for Jose Alvarado, but it does go to your point that the bullpen is a mess. You know, you said that the Rays don't really have a corresponding move. I mean, the Rays have in the past done these bullpen games, but usually Matt Andrees has been involved in those, and now he's kind of locked himself into a rotation spot. But the Rays do have two other good young starters in, well, I won't say good, but at least highly touted young starters in AAA, because while Brent Honeywell has recently moved up to AAA and has looked pretty sharp and could be on the fast track to making the majors soon, they also had Chue Hu up earlier in the season, and he's on the 40, and he could slot in and get another crack at the rotation, I would think, at least on a short-term basis. But I don't know. I think Honeywell's the long-term answer as part of the rotation. It's just a matter of whether or not the Rays want to be really aggressive bringing him up, and that's not a very Rays thing to do, is to be aggressive with a starting pitching prospect. So I imagine they want to wait on him, right?
Right, and the Rays thing to do right now would be to bring back Austin Pruitt and let him try to start, even though if you look at his numbers, he was getting clobbered in relief. I think he had like two or three good games, and people were like, see, this is why they showed patience with him, and then he went back to getting beat around the park. They also have Jacob Faria in the minors and in AAA even, and he hasn't been, you know, pristine with his command either. However, he has struck out 14.4 per nine over 7 starts. So maybe he gets the call, but you're right, it's probably going to be Hugh if they do bring up someone who's interesting as opposed to just going the Erasmo route.
Yeah, and, you know, Erasmo does have the flexibility to pitch long, but I think the Rays probably need him maybe as that long guy in the bullpen, because it's with Andrees and with some of the other starters that the Rays have, they're not necessarily 8-inning guys. You know, being able to have a long reliever is absolutely necessary for this Rays team, probably.
I would agree with that. And, you know, we have Diego Moreno around now, so who knows? Maybe.
Literally, who knows? that's not saying a whole lot, but they do have Diego Moreno. So long-term outlook, or I guess more of a midterm outlook for the rest of this season, I mean, do you think that Snell's going to put it together? What is your kind of hope at this point? Do you think he's going to be able to put it together, or is this one of those situations where he might find himself in the bullpen sooner rather than later?
My hope is for world peace in Greece 3, Brian. But with Snell, I feel like he's going to get better because it's hard to get worse. Yeah. And I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I'm going to try to not to overreact to, you know, 24 big league starts from a the guy who's like 24, and a year ago this time we were talking about how he's, you know, going to be a front of a rotation starter. So it's been ugly. It's been far less than what everyone expected, but I'm not going to hit the eject button just yet, even if I'm going to be a little more cautious with him heading forward. But I'm not going to overreact and be like, no, he's done. Put him in the bullpen. He's new Oliver Perez, you know?
Yeah.
So
I'm with you. I think that he should get every possible opportunity to start for the next 2 years. It does seem a little terrifying, though, the thought of him being a kind of end of the game relief option, because if his stuff plays up a little bit in a conversion to relief, and he's not having to throw all these incredibly inefficient pitches in a game, he could be a really scary bullpen option in the eighth or the ninth inning if things don't work out. So, I mean, even the downside, I think, on Snell is pretty high still. But just hopefully, I'm totally with you. I think you got to give him enough chances to start until he's like 27 before you want to give up on a guy like that.
Yes. Maybe he's the new Scott Kazmir. You never know.
So that's a good example of a guy going down and being a little disappointing, but everything balances out in Major League Baseball, and we actually have had quite a few interesting call-ups this past weekend, but I don't think there's been one more interesting or more hyped than Ian Happ coming up for the Chicago Cubs. What's constantly called a polished or a professional hitter, Happ is just more depth for the offense in Chicago. They could use a little bit of a boost right now, but they've had a lot of injuries and guys a little bit banged up, maybe not disabled list worthy. And so Happ coming up to play a little bit of second base, maybe a little bit of outfield. It's very interesting. He's a top prospect, and he's had just phenomenal success in double and triple A. RJ, is Ian Happ here to stay in Chicago, or do you think that this guy is going to head back down to the minors sooner rather than later?
I would guess it's a short-term stay. That said, you never know. Maybe you know, fate aligns and he's there for the long term. But you know, just to inform everybody about Happ, he was ranked number 2 in the system by BP entering the year. You know, he's a good all-around hitter. You cited his performance in the minors this season in 116 plate appearances at AAA. This being his first exposure to AAA, he hit .298 with a .362 on-base percentage and a .615 slugging. He's not going to hit for that kind of power in the majors. However, you know, he's got a chance to be a gap hitter with a very good approach and some bat-to-ball skills. And the question of him has really been, where is he going to play defensively? Because, you know, we talked about it last week, though. It's almost like baseball is kind of headed into this positionless frontier, like what basketball has done, where, you know, everybody's cross-training, everybody's got a secondary position. And I wonder if in a few years we're going to look back and be like, you know what, Ian Happ should have been a more well-regarded prospect because of that. Like, at what point does that versatility or that uncertainty about your defensive position actually become, like, a positive? Especially if if you can play up the middle, obviously you should play up the middle. But if you're, you know, Ian Happ, does it benefit him to just pick between like left field and second base, or by playing both, is he improving his stock? You know, I guess the thing is, like, can everyone cross train without it impacting their offense or their, you know, their defensive skills at those positions? And I'm not sure the answer to that, but I do wonder if we're going to look back and feel like, you know what, we might have underrated him as a prospect, even though, you know, he's second in the strong farm system, you know, so he's not really underrated in the sense that, oh, nobody knows who Ian Happ was or is. You know, he was a top 10 pick in the draft, too. So I'm not pretending that he's this unheralded prospect. I'm just wondering if maybe he's going to be a more valuable big league player because of how the Cubs can use him than we're expecting right now, just based on the defensive uncertainty.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, the As Jarrett Seidler brought up in the call-up at BP, he's a guy who really can kind of stand at second base, but he's certainly not a top-tier defensive option. You know, if you were going to compare him to Javier Baez defensively, I don't think there's any question that the Cubs would much rather have Baez as a defensive second baseman rather than Happ. I think one of the reasons why Happ might be a little bit underrated, like you said, as a prospect, He doesn't really have a standout tool. You mentioned that his power has kind of shot up in AAA this year, but that's PCL. You know, you really have to take that a little bit with a grain of salt. But Hap's kind of got like he's got good bat to ball abilities. I think he's always been kind of looked at as, you know, above average in terms of his hit tool. The power's been always, you know, average to a little bit above average. So he's not a guy who's got one really interesting, strong carrying tool the same way, you know, other guys in the system, you know, with Schwarber, you had the power, with Bryant, you had the power, with some other guys, they have a little bit more of a hit tool. He's kind of really well-rounded. Sometimes that turns out to be a guy like, you know, Bradley Zimmer of the Indians, who's a prospect who was rising pretty quickly and putting up good numbers in the minors, but kind of hit a snag at some point. And sometimes the tools turn out to be a little bit less than the sum of the package, where with Hap, he's had really strong statistical numbers in the minor leagues as well. So you get the impression, maybe he's going to be a little bit more than what some of the tools might be, because you have those kind of secondary things that can help those you know, mediocre to slightly above average tools play up a little bit.
Yeah, and it's one of the great things about prospecting. By great, I mean irritating things, is that some of these guys with, you know, five average or better tools, they seem to play up, while the other ones, I mean, similar guys. I mean, Mikey Matuk, speaking of like collegiate outfielders who were taking early in the draft, the report on him was, oh, you know, he's got five average or so tools, you know, he should be quick to the majors and all. And, you know, what's worked out with him? Not much, you know. So right. Hap, I guess it comes down to the hit tool, really. You know, that's the most important tool for a reason. And Hap's probably got a better hit tool than Mikey Matuk, who's hit 226 and 353 plate appearances, and he struck out 112 times. So that kind of gives you an idea about what his hit tool has done. So yeah, it comes down to the hit tool, and Hap seems to have a much better chance than your average prospect who's well-rounded without, like you said, a carrying tool to make this work. So I'm curious to see more of him. And if you're the Cubs, how are you going to fit this guy into the lineup? Like, at what point do you just say, you know what, we're going to have to trade somebody? And what do you target? A fifth starter? Obviously not like a fifth starter in terms of quality, but in terms of a guy they can plug into the back of this rotation and give them, you know, five legitimate starters instead of four and, you know, Eddie Butler or Mike Montgomery or Brett Anderson. Or, you know, what do you do with this logjam of talented positional players?
You were reading my mind. That was exactly what I wanted to talk about next, is because with him and with Condelario now on the 40-man roster, when the Cubs are healthy, there's no place for most of these guys, and they've got to figure out something to do with them. And it's not even like they've got guys on like expiring contracts coming up soon. You've got Hayward, who at this point probably is not going to opt out of his deal. You know, John Jay, sure, he might be out fairly soon, but I mean, the entire rest of the roster, they might get a little bit expensive with a couple of guys hitting arbitration soon, but you don't have any holes that are opening up for these guys. So the question, what do you do with these guys? I think you have to make some sort of trade. I'll just be really interested to see what kind of direction they want to go in with that. Do they want to trade the younger guys, like, you know, maybe a Candelario or a Hap? Or does it make more sense for this team to trade away one of the more established players, maybe like a Schwarber or a Baez, where you might get a little bit more of a return, but you're giving up a little bit more certainty? I would think, given the way that the Cubs have been building and the extreme amount of depth they have, I mean, we're not even talking about Eloy Jimenez, who looks like he could be a stud in a couple of years in the outfield. I kind of would expect them to make another deal kind of like that Soler for Wade Davis deal, and just like you said, kind of attack a starter. It just is really interesting to me, because I think that if they were to make Schwarber or Baez available, you can start talking about a Jose Quintana type player, whereas if it's going to be Hap or Candelario, I think you've got to go down a tier in terms of whatever kind of starting pitcher might be available. I don't know. It you know, these things always depend on how the other teams kind of view them, but I don't know. If you were Theo Epstein, what would you do?
I would trade for Blake Snell, so we'd have a nice transition, some nice synergy here. Yeah. See, the thing is, I was someone who thought that Soler would be a better player than Schwarber because of the athleticism, and, you know, I don't know. It was kind of stupid in retrospect, but yeah, I don't know. I guess I would have to think about trading Schwarber. I know he supposedly means a lot to that clubhouse, and you know, he has a great story, but it's just so hard for me to see him being a long-term National League player on a team that has a long-term first baseman in place, and a long-term first baseman who, by the way, is a better hitter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are they really going to put up with the next 3 to 5 years of him playing left field? I just have a hard time seeing that, no matter how great he is in the clubhouse. So I would think he would probably be the most likely one to go, but I don't know. At this point, it's not like they can really go wrong as long as they get a good pitcher back. You know, at some point, it's kind of a law, you know, law of diminishing returns here. You can only have so many position players because you can only find playing time for so many of these guys, and you're kind of wasting your assets if you're having, you know, Ian Happ or whomever sit on the bench 5 out of every 7 days because you have better players in front of them.
He seems like a natural replacement for Ben Zobrist because Zobrist can stand at second and play the outfield. He's a switch hitter like Zobrist. But then, you know, Zobrist is on this is the second year of his 4-year deal. I mean, he's not going anywhere. And he's a big clubhouse guy. You know, one of the things people might start to think about is, well, okay, who can you get the most for? Is it maybe Anthony Rizzo because he's on a cheap contract and because he's an MVP caliber player and you've got Chris Bryant and you can move somebody over? But I mean, that's just like when you start thinking that through, that's crazy. Like, because Rizzo's on a cheap contract and he's an MVP caliber player and there's no reason to trade him, even though you could get the most back for him. So you have to look at these other options. I'm with you. I think Schwarber's the guy that I would move first and foremost. And I mean, Candelario too. I don't think he really has a fit on this team, but then you got to look at it. And if you're, I wonder if teams see that the Cubs are kind of overloaded with these players and might use that against them in negotiations. You know, they probably will ask for the top tier players for their pitching assets and not be as interested and hope that they're kind of this logjam that they've got might force their hand more than anything else. I don't know. It's a really it's a great position to be in. It would be a little bit greater if the Cubs were playing a little bit better right now, but I would have to think they've got to be pretty aggressive in going for another starter just because the questions about Arrieta and Lackey probably aren't long for this team. Unless the Cubs really want to be aggressive in re-signing Arrieta this offseason, I just have to imagine that they are going to need a lot more starting pitching soon and dealing 1, 2, 3 of these guys to try to get a long-term pitching asset. It's a risk, but it's probably a risk they might have to take.
Yeah, and just to follow up on the Zobrist thought, he is in his second year of a 4-year contract, but you know, he's almost 36 years old, and so far his performance really hasn't been that good this season. And
yeah,
you know, I love him and all, but you know, it's not unheard of for a 36-year-old second baseman, primarily a second baseman, to kind of crater. And I wonder, you know, if there's one player on this roster who I could see being like, okay, I will accept a lesser role for the better of the team. I mean, isn't it Ben Zobrist? You know, maybe I would hate to see him benched after, you know, again, it's like 112 at-bats or whatever. But if he continues to struggle, you know, if this back issue he's dealing with is serious, you know, maybe that's the answer. Maybe he slides into a lesser role and they slot in Baez or Happ or whatever young talented player they want to slide in there. But I guess that would be one way to solve part of this, is if Zobrist is, you know, relegated to more of a bench role or a super utility role. I guess that'd be a fitting into his career too, if he's back into playing, you know, all these different positions or what have you as a reserve player rather than as a starter. But yeah, I don't know. They have some very tough, if envious questions to answer in the coming months. And like you said, you know, they're really putting a lot of pressure on that bullpen right now. And you don't want to put a lot of pressure on Wade Davis and Koji Uehara given their injury issues. So yeah, I think they're gonna figure it out, but I'm really curious to see what they do on the trade market over the next few months.
Yeah, it's funny to think about it after they, you know, were so dominant last year and kind of, you know, crushed their way to that World Series championship. You thought this was a team without a lot of holes, and now you look at this rotation and you look at the bullpen and you say, boy, they could actually really use some help this year. They could be aggressive in the trade market and make some moves and really get some pieces that would help them out. Another back of the bullpen guy, another starter, hopefully a long-term one. They're a team that actually could deal with making some of these moves. So this depth is probably going to pay off for them. Zobrist is another guy. I wonder if he would be a guy they would be trying to trade if he continued. I mean, it would be selling low on him, but I mean, if there really is, you know, kind of this this idea that they might want to move on to him, I'm sure there are some teams, you know, contending teams that would be interested in adding him to their roster despite his diminished production. I mean, he's a great clubhouse guy, got a great reputation as a winner, and you know, he's one of those guys that definitely makes enough contact in addition to his walk rate that I think no matter what a team's kind of offensive profile is, he probably fit in well for them.
That makes sense. He's always been a guy who can fit at the top of the order. Well, except for when he first came up.
Right.
I mean, when this dude first came up, he had the bowl cut. He was gangly. And I swear to you, he faked a bunt every single time up. He would come up, he'd square up. And no, he couldn't hit the ball out of the infield. So pitchers weren't concerned, whatever. They're like, okay, I mean, you're going to get out either way. So they just force feed him strikes. And then all of a sudden, he started being able to turn on those strikes. And it's really been amazing to watch. He went from a guy in his mid-20s who couldn't hit the ball out of the infield to a guy who was hitting 20 home runs. I think he has two 20-home-run seasons. He almost had a 30-home-run season. It's really, really impressive and a testament to his work ethic. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Ben Zobrist, and I was very, very wrong about him because in 2009, when Zobrist took over for Aki Iwamura, I thought Willie Ibar was the better pick. So Ooh. Sorry about that, Ben Zobrist. I will never, ever, ever, ever pick Willie Ibar over you in anything again. And Willie Ibar, we'll save that one for another day.
Yeah, that's a bad look in hindsight. But nobody really misses Willie Ibar, I don't think. He was a weird, weird sort of guy. From Willie Ibar to the other small minor moves of the weekend, let's bring in Sean Brody, our producer, and let's go over some of the lesser of the moves of the last couple of days and the weekend. Sean, hit us with our batting practice segment.
So to start out, we're going to have Kenta Maeda to the disabled list with a left hamstring injury. He will start off this segment for us. He had a good start his last time out, a shutout into the ninth inning before Francisco Cervelli hit a two-run homer off of him, and homers have been a problem for him this season in general. Hyunjin Ryu was taken off the disabled list. He gave up 10 runs on Thursday, so his spot is going to be skipped Tuesday, and Rich Hill with a chance to come off the disabled list and pitch on Tuesday with Ryu being pushed to Thursday. So what do we make from all of this Los Angeles Dodgers starting madness?
Well, it's just some good old-fashioned roster manipulation, really. Andrew Friedman has always been a bit of a trickster when it comes to the disabled lists. A few years back, Gabe Kapler suffered this really well-timed career-ending ankle sprain. It cost him like 2 months, and I think he went to spring training with the Dodgers the following spring and didn't make the team. But, you know, Friedman has always had the good fortune of a bit player coming up with this injury that's not really severe, but just severe enough to require a little bit of a disabled list stay until someone else got hurt or until rosters expanded in order to fix a roster crunch. So this seems akin to me to resting players in the NBA. Because if you read Dave Roberts' comments about Maeda, it was like, well, he had a hamstring thing a few weeks ago. And after we saw Rich Hill's rehab out, and we figured, oh, we'll put Maeda on the disabled list. And it's like really nonchalant about something that's probably going to tick teams off. Like, even if you assume every other team does the same thing, they're not quite as forthcoming about it in the press. So, yeah, I feel like this is a situation where the Dodgers probably should have just said, oh, his hamstring came up, you know, last night at the end of the game or when he was walking to his car or whatever. And otherwise, this is just blatant roster manipulation in a way that might go unchallenged, but will probably be frowned upon by the rest of the league.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I definitely agree with you. It's roster manipulation. It's this game of you're going to be able to put a guy on the DL and rotate these guys in and out of the DL, so you don't really have to affect the bullpen too much by these moves. I just think it's really interesting that Ryu and Maeda have had kind of the same problem this year, with the strikeouts have been good, the walk rate's been okay, but they've both really had home run problems. And so I wonder if this is kind of the moment where the luck's going to shift a little bit, maybe for the Dodgers and maybe for both these pitchers, because I think, you know, if reasonably healthy, both of them can probably reduce their home run issues, and all of a sudden their stats will look quite a bit better. The big kind of, like, you know, sort of Damocles hanging over the Dodgers right now is Rich Hill and his comeback, because, you know, either of these guys would easily be moved out of the rotation for Hill if he were healthy and effective. But Hill has been weirdly, he's had no control, as opposed to the barest semblance of control which he's happened to have, you know, over the last couple of seasons. I wonder about Hill, and it sounds like David Roberts has said something about possibly moving him to the bullpen, which would be very kind of a strange decision to make, unless he really can't keep that blister from forming after a couple of innings. I think that would be a really weird roster kind of move, because of, you know, the way Hill is kind of a critical part of this this rotation. So I'm really interested to see how this kind of pans out. But yeah, it's weird watching the Dodgers kind of manipulate this new 10-day DL this way. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if other teams play a little copycat with this and start doing the same thing, especially teams like the Orioles or you know, other teams that are having some serious starting pitching woes.
Yeah, but the Orioles will have the depth to pull it off.
That's you know, true.
You know, it takes like having like six or seven big league caliber starters to really pull this off well. Otherwise, you know, you're kind of putting yourself in a situation where you have to start an undesirable for at least one game. So, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know how many teams are going to be able to copy it, or at least copy it as well as the Dodgers are able to implement it. But I wonder about the Rich Hill thing. I know you mentioned potentially shifting him to the bullpen because of the blisters. Would pitching in relief help with blisters, or would that cause more flare-ups? Because I'm thinking, like, he's going to have to warm up more often, and, you know, he's going to be throwing more in sense of, or at least more often, if not more, in terms of total pitches. So I'm just curious, like, do blisters really go away when you shift to relief, or is that just something that's going to pop up regardless? I guess it depends on, like, when he's suffering them. Is it after, you know, 50, 75 pitches, or is it just the constant duress there that his fingers are under, or is it just something that's going to pop up no matter what because of the friction with the baseball and how it affects his skin? I don't know. I don't know enough about how blisters are caused to really, you know, diagnose whether moving him to the bullpen would help with that issue or not.
Yeah, these are all good questions. I think it could be just one of those things where it's, you know, time to experiment, you know, got to try something different because what they're doing now doesn't seem to be working. But yeah, that's a good point. You know, maybe this wouldn't actually solve any of their problems if they move them to the bullpen. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
So moving from the Dodgers rotation to the Yankees bullpen, Aroldis Chapman is sent to the 10-day disabled list with rotator cuff inflammation. He is supposed to miss about a month, maybe 2 weeks at the least. The worst part is it was discovered on Derek Jeter Day.
that's definitely the worst part about it. I don't know. I think, you know, Chapman is an integral part of this Yankees rotation, but the Yankees are relatively well equipped to deal with it. I mean, they still do have Dellin Betances, and yeah, I know Betances isn't the same type of closer that that Chapman is, but, you know, this could happen at a much worse time for this team, at least. I mean, Betances has been striking out more guys than Chapman. Yeah, the control hasn't been good at all, but, you know, with Betances in place and a relatively strong bullpen around him, this probably doesn't affect the Yankees all that much. And, you know, I'm not going to cry over Aroldis Chapman losing out on some innings. So this actually could be a lot worse. I think the Yankees are okay equipped to deal with it.
Yeah, and Chapman's had some weirdness this season. If you look at his hit rate, it's up to 8.5 per nine, which is way higher than you would anticipate for him. You know, his previous career high, 6.1, and that came in 13 innings his rookie season. So whatever's going on there, you know, the Yankees certainly do have more than suitable fill-ins, but, you know, Chapman definitely not his characteristic self this season, and we'll see if this is an indicator of something more serious or if he'll be back in a month and his numbers will correct themselves.
His velocity is down just a little bit from last year as well. I mean, it's you can't expect him to live 100-plus on his four-seamer all the time, but both his slider and his four-seamer are down a little bit from where they were when he was at his best in the middle of last season. So I wonder if that might be part of what's making him a little bit more hittable this year as well, because that's a good note. So maybe some of this injury might have something to do with it, kind of lurking in the background a little bit. Maybe when he comes back, he'll be back to his old self. Who knows?
So moving from one stalwart of a New York bullpen to another stalwart of the bullpen, this one for the New York Mets, Jeurys Familia on the 10-day disabled list with a blood clot in his right arm. He's likely going to miss more days. It's actually thought from the beginning that he was going to miss the entire season because of the surgery. However, the team came back, I think a couple days ago, and said the surgery was not as extensive as expected, and Familia will resume throwing in 6 weeks. At this point, do we trust anything the Mets team comes out and says in terms of injuries?
No. No. This is wild to me, because if he starts throwing in 6 weeks, he's probably not going to be back for 3 or 4 months to the majors, which, let me count, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, that's like September, October, and at this rate, the Mets aren't exactly, sprinting towards playing meaningful baseball in September and October. It's possible. I mean, they're not as bad as the injuries and the sometimes awful performances make it seem. They're still pretty close to 500. But this is a real blow for the Mets, because while the Mets have a couple of really good arms in their bullpen, they don't have depth, and they could really use some stability at the back end of their bullpen. You know, Familia has been having some really serious control issues this year, but from a strikeout perspective, he's been his old self. This is a real blow to the Mets. And, again, nobody is really excited about Jeurys Familia at this point, thanks to the domestic violence issues. But I think this one actually makes a big deal for the Mets. And it's I wouldn't expect to see him back this year just because of the way the Mets have been downplaying every single injury that's come up in the interim.
Yeah, and to your point, Brian, last week I wrote about the Mets bullpen usage at CBSSports.com. Make sure you watch The Big Bang Theory and Superior Donut. Thank you. But here's the thing about the Mets bullpen usage. They far and away lead the league in appearances on 0 days rest. And I haven't checked the numbers today, but when I wrote about it on Thursday, I believe it was, they had 45 such appearances, and there was one other team that had more than 30, and that was the Brewers at 30. So they actually – Jerry Blevins had 9 by himself, which was more than the Cincinnati Reds had as a team. So, they've really used Blevins and Reed and Robles and even Familia and Edgen. They've used them a ton on 0 days rest. I think there's 27 pitchers in baseball who have 5-plus appearances on 0 days rest this season, and the Mets had 6 of them, 6 That's of wild. 27. So Terry Collins has really been leaning on those individuals, and we don't know a lot about reliever usage and how it impacts performance over a season or even over a long haul, but the Mets seem destined to test out, how often can your top arms throw on 0 days rest? How often can they redline before they crash and burn? And I don't know the answer. I don't know. Maybe it works all season long. This is something they did last year as well. And it seems like a strategy that's born from the rotation's issues. In 2015, they weren't among the top teams in using the relievers as aggressively as they have for the last two seasons. So the rotation can find a way to get healthy and, get more consistent with the depth of games and what have you, then maybe this won't be as big of an issue. But like you said, right now, this does not seem like a team that's built to shoulder the load with an extended Familia absence.
So just to kind of play off the overuse of the bullpen that you've been saying, Jerry Blevins leads baseball with 21 appearances so far this season, 20 appearances for Addison Reed and Fernando Salas, who's been terrible. And then Hansel Robles has made it into 19 games, and Josh Eggen has made it into 18. So those five guys in the Mets bullpen have been used for at least half of the Mets games, if not more. And they have, five guys in the top 30 in appearances in Major League Baseball so far this year. So that's not going to work forever, just like you said.
And, I mean, that's just kind of the running joke with the Mets at this point, right, that Fernando Salas and Jerry Blevins will always be warming in the pen no matter what the scenario in the game is.
Yep.
Yeah, for all sorts of good information about the Mets bullpen, you can check out BP Mets, where people are gnashing their teeth and screaming and have been saying the same thing for 6 months to 9 months to almost a whole year. Terry Collins is not exactly everyone's favorite bullpen manager.
Everyone's favorite manager instead is on Superior Donuts.
I think the one positive thing that could come out of this is Paul Sewald's going to get some innings, and he looked really good so far this season.
Yeah, the thing is, I think that's going to get exposed over time because Sewald, he's a fine pitcher and everything, but he still doesn't have a real – his slider is good. He's been doing very well at giving up zero home runs in his 10 innings that he's pitched so far, and his command has been excellent, and it really has been throughout his minor league career. I just think that the other shoe will eventually drop at some point. When you're giving up, you know, a 25% ground ball rate, eventually a ball's going to leave the park. So we're going to have that happen at some point. But on the converse of that is Addison Reed, who has refused to walk anybody literally this season in his 20 appearances, but has given up more home runs than you can shake a stick at. So I think that'll kind of balance out a little bit too. But it is nice seeing Sewald get some action in there. It's just the problem is that Terry Collins, I don't think, trusts him enough yet, and you know he'll get a lot of leverage leaned on him once Fernando Salas or Hansel Robles or somebody completely breaks down,
which we expect to happen in about a week now.
Yeah.
So moving on, sticking with the Mets, as Drubal Cabrera with a torn ligament in his thumb, except we didn't know it was a torn ligament in his thumb because the team announced there was no ligament damage until yesterday, when reports came out that Asdrubal Cabrera was told there was ligament damage in his thumb. He wants to play through it. The Mets are going to try to let him because, you know, it's not like there's a 10-day disabled list or anything. They will not start him tonight, but it looks like they will put Jose Reyes at shortstop and TJ Rivera at third. If only there was a good prospect in the Mets minor leagues that was batting .355 with a .395 OBP and slugging .486 in AAA, if only there was someone like that who could take a spot.
And, you know, Jose Reyes, what is the obsession with Jose Reyes there? He's been so bad, and they even had him play center field over the weekend. I just don't get that one. I don't get the Jose Reyes obsession.
It's kind of this failing, I think, in the New York Mets front office / ownership. I think it's really something where the Mets are kind of obsessed with keeping guys who are Mets and are used to being in the clubhouse, and they insist upon you know, keeping this continuity in the clubhouse on the roster. And Jose Reyes is you know, a shining example of that continuity. He was a Met for 10 years and now he's a Met, and so he gets to be a Met forever. And that's kind of how that works now. The use of the disabled list thing, we've gone over it before. It's ridiculous. Asdrubal Cabrera, maybe even if he doesn't have ligament damage in his thumb, let's say he doesn't, he should still be on the disabled list. And the team has Matt Reynolds. The team has, you know, Wilmer Flores. They are off the disabled list. They are on the team and available to play. There's no reason why they should be trying to run Asdrubal Cabrera out there right now instead of letting him get healthy. Sean, you were wonderfully passive aggressive about trying to talk about Ahmed Rosario. I understand why the Mets had not wanted to bring him up to start the season. That time is probably over. There's so many things wrong with letting Jose Reyes be the starting shortstop that you have to at least consider bringing Rosario up at this point and letting him play, because he's playing very well in AAA, and he's going to get the job eventually unless the Mets are even crazier than we think they are. So I think now is probably the time to get them going.
Yeah, and at what point do you – I mean, you have to make this move at some point to just to remain in the race. They are 7.5 back in the division. They're like 3 to 5 back in the wild card. I don't have the numbers right in front of me at this point. But, you know, at some point you have to get going and you have to field, you know, a 25-man roster that can realistically compete. Otherwise, what's the point? You know, what are you doing? So I don't see the harm in bringing up Rosario and letting him showcase himself at shortstop for the next however long it takes for Cabrera to heal. I don't know how long it takes, you know, thumb ligaments to heal. Maybe it's 2 weeks, maybe it's 6 weeks. But if he fails, okay, go to Jose Reyes at shortstop. I don't see why Reyes at shortstop is plan A instead of plan B or plan C here. So I'm just really confused by I guess I'm mostly confused. What do they think Jose Reyes is capable of doing right now as a ball player? Because it seems to be way higher than it should be.
Yeah, it seems like every time he has a really bad run, something surprising happens. He had like a good couple of game run last week where I think he hit a dinger. And he started to show signs of potential life at the plate, but he's still hitting below 200. He still has an OBP under 270. He's still a bad defensive shortstop. I mean, he's an all right defensive third baseman, but he should not be playing shortstop under any circumstances at this point. And they've already moved him out of the top of the lineup so that they obviously are recognizing at this point he's no longer a top of the lineup hitter. He's not the speed demon he used to be, because I think those were the carrying characteristics for Terry Collins for much of the start of the season and the end of last season. I really don't know at this point. I could not tell you what the thinking is on their part, but it just seems like he's a AAA player at this point and they need to move on from him. But there's just this tie to the consistency and the regular, these guys who have been in Mets uniforms before, and it's very strange, and it's not at all productive at this point.
And it's just a bit confusing. Probably the best thing going for Rosario is that TJ Rivera is playing well, and they have to put him in the lineup, so it really forces Jose Reyes' hand. It forces him into only one position he could do anything in, really, and that's short.
Yeah, how surprising is it that TJ Rivera is forcing the Mets' hand, because he's playing, he's, you know, hitting 300 still, which nobody I think expected to happen. But yeah, when you got to get TJ Rivera in the lineup, I guess it's just the Mets are just a mess right now. I don't know what else to say.
Join us next time for the Mets are a mess.
I'm sure there will be a constant team we'll talk about in the C block for the rest of the season. But Jose Berrios recalled for the Twins. We'll go on to some happier news. He took the place of Nick Tepish, and he's a touted prospect from Minnesota. So what do we think he's going to produce this season?
Better than last season. I really liked him a few years back when I saw him in the World Baseball Classic, and that was before his prospect stock really shot up. And I was surprised at how bad he was last season. And I suppose, you know, if you kind of buy into statistical significance, that it's a really bad sign to have an ERA over 14 starts, especially to begin your career. But I still believe he's going to be okay, or at least more okay than the company he keeps with that stat line would suggest. And I don't know. I don't know if he's going to live up to the once lofty expectations, but I do think he's going to be at least a mid-rotation starter and someone who the Twins can kind of project as a part of their future rotation, because they really don't have a lot of starting pitchers that you can be like, oh yeah, he'll be there in a year, he'll be there in 2 years. You know, their rotation's really kind of, I don't know, old and sort of uninteresting in a sense. You know, even this season, Arvin Santana has a 1.5 ERA. Did either of you know that he has a 1.5 ERA? Is anyone, you know, paying attention to that? And he's given up 3.8 hits per nine because their defense is really, really good. And I don't think anyone really notices or cares, honestly. And, you know, Phil Hughes, everyone's had their fill of Phil Hughes. And, yeah, I think Berrios is, like, not only a rare youngster in this rotation, but a rare piece of upside, a rare potential long-term piece. So hopefully he does well, and hopefully the Twins can finally take solace in having a young player go from the minors to the majors and actually play well. It seems like Miguel Sandoval has been the only one. I guess Max Kepler more recently, who's done that. You know, Ryan Buxton has been a mess, and you know, they certainly have had some other issues, including Rios last season. So we'll see, but I'm hopeful with him still.
Just to jump in on the Irvin Santana comment, I have Irvin Santana on my one fantasy baseball team, so I'm well aware of his ERA. Thank you very much, Irvin. You're keeping me in contention this year. As far as Jose Berrios goes, you know, last year was just so weird because he was such a he had really reasonable command and control. He was kind of very polished coming into that season last year. I went out on a limb last year before the season and made him my rookie of the year pick, which in hindsight looks pretty stupid. So, yeah, that was a huge mistake. But this year, he's really turned it around in the minor leagues, at least, and really the command came back. The walk rate dropped back down. And then, you know, he made his first start of the season. He not only kept the walk rate down, but he was able to go long into the game. He pitched 7 2/3 innings and only gave up one run. So there's a lot of really heartening signs that he's fixing the issues that he had last year. And if he fixes that command and control issue, then everything else is going to come together for him because his stuff is great. He is pretty polished as far as young starting pitchers go. And, you know, unlike every other Twins pitching prospect over the last, I don't know, half century, he can actually strike guys out. So, yeah, I'm pretty positive on him, too.
And this reminds me of that one great Sam Miller line when he wrote about Twin starting pitchers. And he's like, even the movie Twins has a 6.6 rating at IMDb. That line has stuck with me ever since. So thank you, Sam Miller, for that.
The Nationals activate Sean Kelly and Coda Glover off the disabled list. These two can't do anything apart from each other, apparently. So who will have more innings down the stretch, Sean Kelly or Coda Glover?
I don't know, but here's the thing about Glover that stuck with me. Yes, this is a random tangent, too. Dusty Baker was quoted as saying that Glover was too wild for the ninth inning, and he didn't mean, like, his command or his control weren't there. He meant like he was too wild in terms of personality. And I really just want to know, what does Coda Glover do that Dusty Baker considers too wild to close? You know, like what could you possibly do where Dusty is like, no, actually he's a little too much for the ninth inning. That's just stuck with me. So that doesn't answer your question at all, Sean, but I'm fascinated by what in the world does Coda Glover do that gets that kind of reaction from Dusty Baker?
Dusty had Jonathan Papelbon in the bullpen.
Right.
And Aroldis a couple years ago, and, you know, he has some wildness to him in addition to his legal troubles. So, I don't know.
I was big on Sean Kelly coming into this season, and he's been so bad. And then coming off the disabled list, he pitched in his first game on Sunday, and he gave up 3 runs on 3 hits and a walk in 1/3 of an inning. And I don't know. I think he might be – there might be something really wrong with him. He's given up what I think, you know, several home runs. He's given up as many home runs as he has walks since he started this season with the Nationals. I'm afraid he might be a little bit broken, and if that's the case, then we're going to still have Matt Albers probably closing games for the Nationals, and that's – really bad. They need to go ahead and get somebody stable for the back of the bullpen that's going to be able to shut down games for them, because, you know, they do have a very clear path to the playoffs right now, but when it comes time for the playoffs, they're going to need somebody else at the back of that bullpen to hold up, and I'm just not sure Kelly is capable of doing it this year.
Yeah, and just to follow up with the stats here, he's given up 4.8 walks per nine. He's also given up 4.8 homers per nine. And, you know, the underrated bad actor in that bullpen is Joe Blanton. We all kept saying, why is Joe Blanton unsigned? You know, I even asked, like, why hasn't Blanton gotten a deal? And they were just like, And in 12 innings this season, Blanton's given up 20 hits, 14 runs, 13 of them earned, 6 home runs. And he's also walking he's walking fewer than Kelly. I was looking at the wrong stat line there. So he's not walking hitters. He's just getting hit around the park otherwise. And they're turning to, like, Jake Turner as, like, a meaningful reliever for them this early in the season. So they certainly do need to go out and find some bullpen help before the deadline. And maybe two arms. Maybe not just one arm. Maybe two arms who can slot in near the back of the bullpen, because I don't think a team that's as good as the Nationals can afford to go into the postseason with any Romero and Jake Turner playing big parts in their bullpen. Plus Matt Albert. I mean, those three should not be among your three best relievers. You have issues if those three are like your most dependable relievers.
You have Alex Colomé down for the Rays. You have Kelvin Herrera for the Royals if the Royals kind of start to falter. Even for the Pirates, should the Pirates want to sell off, you have Tony Watson there. So just a quick hit. Who do you guys think the Nationals will go out and get as a back-of-the-bullpen guy?
I mean, the Tony Watson idea a lot. And the Nationals and Pirates have, you know, some history together dating back to last trade deadlines. So, but I could, you know, I could honestly see them stealing Alex Colomé from the Rays too for some projection system superstar. So I don't know. I'm torn. I'm going to go with Watson though. That makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, he'd give them – he had another lefty to throw out there in addition to Perez and Romero. So that could be interesting come playoff time, especially if they match up against the Cubs or Dodgers.
And I will stick with the guy who's been rumored in Nationals trades for ages, and that's David Robertson. I think that he's the guy they wind up going after and getting. He's had a nice bounce back season so far for Chicago. He's pitching, you know, fairly well, and I think he's the right combination of a team that's going to be far enough out of contention, despite how well the White Sox have played at some points so far this season. The contract is big, and as we've established, the Nationals don't care about that. And I think the White Sox would be happy to get, I don't know, somebody like an A.J. Cole or a Wilmer Defoe or somebody like that as part of a deal to restock for the future. So Watson is a really intriguing and interesting idea because I think that the team, the Nationals especially, could really use a left-hander. So maybe the best possible situation is them going out and getting both of them.
So moving forward now, we stick with a disabled list stint. This one is a guy being put on, and that's Ryan Braun for the Milwaukee Brewers. Braun has been phenomenal this year, batting .287 and slugging .574. So who takes his place?
That's a tough one. I guess it would probably be like a Domingo Santana at this point, but there is no way to replace him for this team at this point, I don't think. I mean, you know, eventually Brett Phillips is going to probably move into that spot, but he's still a ways away. I just, I have a lot of difficulty trying to peg exactly how this Brewers team is doing the things that they're doing. I just don't think that there's a reasonable replacement for him at all. And, you know, the Brewers have been succeeding on the strength of Thames and Shaw and Braun. And so this is going to be a big blow to them. But we kind of expected this team to fall off at some point this season. So it's not necessarily surprising that something would eventually go wrong since everything's been going right for them up to this point.
Yeah, and I don't think there's many replacements across baseball for Ryan Braun. This is his 11th season. He's had an OPS plus of 130 or better in 10 of those seasons, including this one. So, you know, we'll see where it goes from here. But he is an incredible hitter and has been an incredible hitter since he stepped into a major league batter's box. So there's no replacing him. They can only hope that someone gets hot and does a decent impression of him until he's back.
And so we'll stick with the Brewers now for this next one. Eric Sogard has been called up. Did not know he was an actual Brewer until I did the Mets recap on Friday. Apparently he left the A's at some point. And do you remember when they had the face of the MLB competition? I want to say it was 2013 and 2014. And Eric Sogard nearly beat David Wright for the face of Major League Baseball. What?
I do remember that. Otherwise, I mean, what can you say here? He had one season where he looked like he could become a solid second base option. That was in 2013, and otherwise he's just been a complete zero with the bat. He does have a good glove, but, you know, you really don't want to be playing Eric Sogard very often if you're hosting competitive aspirations. So good for Eric Sogard that he's back in the majors, but, you know, collective shrug otherwise.
Yeah, this is a team that really doesn't need Eric Sogard too much. I mean, one of the reasons why I think that they brought him up is because their utility guy, kind of extraordinaire, Hernan Perez, has been taking over in left field with the Braun injury and everything. So I think that's kind of the big difference behind it, but they've already got Nick Franklin and they've already got Perez. And so Sogard will get a little bit of game, but he'll mainly just be there to be the face of the Brewers. And yeah, it's going to be a short run, I think, for him after missing, I think, almost all of last year, if not the whole season. Yeah. So.
Also, you just uttered the phrase, they already have Nick Franklin, they already have Hernan Perez, and it was meant sincerely.
Yeah.
What a situation.
He's worse than those guys.
They already have Ivan DeJesus Jr. in the minors. You need Eric Sogard. So yes, we're in the snarky portion of the C block. What else you got for us, Sean?
So a couple more for you now. The Tigers activated JD Martinez from the disabled list. Can the Tigers keep it going this season?
I really thought they were. I actually predicted them to make the wild card, and then as the season has gone on, I've felt worse and worse about that decision. But Martinez being out was a huge blow to that offense. This should be a top-tier offense, but the team is not deep. I do think that they're still in contention, and I think they'll remain in contention until somebody proves otherwise, and they're a 500 team right now. But Martinez is a huge part of the offense, and getting him back will be a big big improvement for them. I just they shouldn't be running Andrew Romine out there in center field regularly. That's very bad. You can't really be a contender with Andrew Romine starting in center field. And the pitching needs to step it up a little bit too. But I do think that Martinez coming back to be a huge improvement for them. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them go on a little bit of a run now.
No mention of Jim Meducci, who played surprisingly well during his 13-game cameo. So,
and is now on the disabled list swap places with JD.
And he'll probably never get an extended look. So good job for Jim Meducci, a 32-year-old, mostly career minor leaguer who, hey, if nothing else, he'll be able to say he was Wally Pipped by JT Martinez, even if that's not quite how things actually worked out. But it makes for a good story, right?
Just one other thing to throw out here. With Martinez up and Aducci down, there is no left-handed hitter on the regular lineup for this Tigers team. They've got a couple of switch hitters in Victor Martinez and Andrew Romine, but they could really use some sort of left-handed bat to be able to pull off the bench or something like that, because they got nothing right now other than Aducci, who's on the disabled list. So maybe when he gets healthy, he'll come back up and replace, you know, maybe Tyler Collins or something. But they could really use a left-handed bat.
So keeping in the AL Central with a man named Martinez, the Indians DFA'd Michael Martinez.
Yeah, I mean, it's Michael Martinez. I guess you feel bad for him in the sense that he actually started the season pretty well for his standards, you know, 4 hits and 11 at-bats, and he was probably feeling pretty good about himself. And he gets designated for assignment anyway. And, you know, he's got to be looking at his career numbers like, really? This is what got me designated for assignment? I had a 690 OPS with you last season, and you kept me. And now I'm getting designated for assignment just because I'm doing well in my first, you know, 11 at-bats? That's rotten. But, yeah, I mean, this is literally the 25th man on that team, and nobody cares about Michael Martinez. I'm sorry, Michael, but it's true.
I care about Michael Martinez. Miami McEwing scores every year. He is a superstar when it comes to playing multiple positions.
He fits this year, too.
Yeah. So. Unfortunately, Michael Martinez may be a McEwing score superstar, but in general, he is one of the worst players in baseball over the last 5 or 6 years. It's astonishing that he's been able to keep a job. Despite, you know, his ability to play multiple positions, because he's so bad at all of them, he is easily one of the worst offensive players in baseball over the last 6 years. He makes Jeff Mathis look like, I don't know, Ryan Braun. he's so bad. So this year he's had, like you said, 14 plate appearances, 11 at bats. He hit a double, which, you know, happens once in a blue moon for him. He's gotten 4 hits, which is great. It's not something that's sustainable because his career batting average is 200. His career true average is 200. He's just a terrible hitter, and there's no real excuse for rostering him, even if you're the Indians, because they have enough depth and versatility in their position players with guys like Jose Ramirez and Yandy Diaz, who can play multiple positions in the infield. It's just it was mystifying to me that he's managed to hold his job this long. He'll get DFA'd. I wouldn't be surprised if some other team picks him up because somebody always seems to want him. The Red Sox, the Indians, the Phillies. That, you know, he's had a job for a while, but whatever team gets him will get, by all accounts, a nice guy, a versatile player, and a truly awful hitter.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of his staying power is just connected to that Mini Mart nickname, because it's a great nickname. Being honest, you know,
absolutely.
And the guy who's standing the benefit here is Yandy Diaz as well. Well, I guess you can also say Eric Gonzalez is standing the benefit, and he made BA's top 10 prospect list for the Indians. And this season in AAA, he's hit 269, 293, 455. You know, that's actually a pretty big upgrade over what Michael Martinez would offer if he can come close to that in the majors. So we'll see what Gonzalez offers, but frankly, it's really not going to matter because, as Brian noted, Michael Martinez makes Jeff Mathis look like Ryan Braun. So we'll see. It's probably not going to make much difference either way, though.
I can guarantee if Michael Martinez listened to our podcast before this episode, he might be leaving us for good after. So our last move of the show, Francisco Liriano sent to the 10-day disabled list with left shoulder inflammation. He was trying to play through the injury. Ultimately succumbed to the disabled list, as we all must. Aaron Sanchez activated from the disabled list in his place, and he started on Sunday. So with Liriano, in his 7 starts this season, he has walked more batters than innings pitched in 3. And his walk rate is hovering around 7 right now. His walk per 9 is hovering around 7. So
that's a usual Francisco Liriano season, right?
Yeah, I don't trust him. I know we've talked about him as a potential addition to a contender's rotation before, but I just do not trust him, and I would not feel comfortable adding him as an answer. You know, maybe as your 5th guy who moves to the bullpen during the postseason, but otherwise I don't trust him whatsoever. And I guess the interesting thing here is really Toronto's rotation now with Liriano out and with Hap's continued absence. They have turned – well, for almost, they've turned to Mike Bolsinger, who we've all kind of forgot existed. Or at least I forgot he existed. I remember he had like a decent run with the Dodgers not long ago. But they've also turned to Bijani. And, you know, he kind of came out of nowhere last season to really have a respectable to good year out of the bullpen. And now they've converted him to relief. So, I don't know. Do you think this is going to work, Brian? Do you think maybe Liriano getting hurt can actually lead to a good thing for their long term, because, you know, they get a look at this guy in the rotation?
I mean, the Joe Biagini experience has been pretty spectacular so far. As a Rule 5 guy who was picked up from the Giants in 2015, he pitched relatively well out of the bullpen for the Blue Jays last year, but in the 2 starts he's had so far this season, he looks awfully sharp. The ground ball thing is really great for him. He's got good command, good control, and keeps the ball down while getting a few strikeouts. I don't imagine he's going to continue to pitch with like a 2-ish ERA, but I think it was good that they gave him a shot. I think this is going to work out okay for them. I think he could be, you know, a back of the rotation kind of arm for them. I don't know if, like you said, if Liriano is going to be like a long-term fix because he's just so unreliable, I don't know. It's tough to get a real good picture of what the Blue Jays are at this point because they're just dealing with so many of these injuries. But I do think they might have found a winner in Biagini. I think he's the type of guy who had enough success in the minors to kind of pop through. And I wouldn't hold out any hope that Bolsinger will continue to pitch as well as he has, but I think that this will eventually work out okay for them in the short term. It's just a matter of whether or not they can get enough things going right and few enough injuries so that the team can actually be competitive in the AL East, which looks like more and more that might be out of the question.
Yeah, although Toronto has played well lately. They've won 5 in a row. They're now a game back of the Rays for 4th place. Mm-hmm. And they're actually not too far away from Boston. 2.5 games entering play on Monday. So I don't know. I don't think it's likely that they're going to compete. I think they dug themselves too big of a hole to be a big part of the American League East heading forward. And, you know, frankly, I think given their poor start, they might be more likely to sell at the deadline than a team in a similar situation who got off to a more of a 500 start, or maybe even a good start and then faded. But I don't know. I guess we shouldn't abandon all hope just yet. Or maybe we should. Maybe we already abandoned hope and now we should get some of that hope back. But it wouldn't surprise me if they overtake the Rays and stay ahead of the Rays. I just don't know that I could foresee them, you know, overtaking Boston, Baltimore, and the Yankees over the long haul. So, yeah, I don't know what else to say about Toronto other than that. So,
it's just so interesting seeing how their lineup has kind of fallen apart given how great the lineup was in 2015 and even 2016. And now they're running, you know, Ryan Goins and Chris Coughlin and Luke Mayle out there every day.
Luke Mayle. He's going to work himself into the segment somehow.
Always. We can't have an episode without him. And, you know, their bench right now is Michael Ullman, Darwin Barney, and Ezekiel Carrera, which is, you know, that's almost a double A bench, not a triple A bench kind of situation. Yes. So there's definitely some weaknesses on this team. And, once you get into such a kind of tailspin at the beginning of the season, it's hard to pull yourself out of it, but it is nice to see them playing well now. And I do think they can recover a little bit just to not embarrass themselves this season, get up to 500, maybe at least make it interesting.
That's fair. And, you know, if we're going to mention Luke Mayle, we might as well give everyone an update on what he's doing. And offensively, he's hitting .032, 118, 0.032 in 34 plate appearances. So his batting average is literally a zero and then lower than his number of plate appearances. That's impressive. You know, I don't think I've ever seen that before. And defensively, the reason he's actually employed, he has 0.1 framing runs this season, according to BP's metrics. So Luke Mayle, everybody, he's still handsome though. He has that next boy next door handsomeness to go with his horrendous offensive line and his so far somewhat disappointing framing runs total. So good for you, Luke Mayle.
So two more comments for you here. Aaron Sanchez started last night, 5 innings, 1 run not earned, 5 hits, 2 walks, 4 strikeouts, but he did deal with a bleeding finger, so he might be a candidate to return to the disabled list going forward. Francisco Liriano's case, have you ever seen a pitcher with a 6-plus ERA that has a higher walk rate?
Maybe in a small sample, but not. I don't know either, honestly. And yeah, if Sanchez goes back to the disabled list, that'd be his third stint this season. You know, he was so good last year, but man, remember when we were all like, "Oh, they shouldn't have sent him down." You know, they're ruining his Cy Young chances and whatnot. Now, it almost seems like maybe they weren't careful enough with him because seems like every time he comes back, he gets broke again. And, hey, maybe we'll see Matt Latos again. That would be whatever the opposite of fun is, you know.
That would be truly awful. I think Sanchez is interesting because I think this almost makes me agnostic to the idea of protecting your young starting pitchers, because you can protect them all you want and they still seem to break. So this makes part of me want to be like, well, just run them out there, you know, give them their 180 innings and just see what happens, because I don't think there's any good way to protect them at this point. It's kind of like how I feel sometimes raising my kid. Like, you know what? There's literally only so much you can do. You just got to let him go out there and live his life. And whatever happens, happens. So not to get too philosophical, but it's like, you know, these things are just so hard to predict what's going to work for a guy and what's not.
Wow, this took a dark turn. It's just like my kids. Just run them out there and they're gonna get hurt. So maybe we'll.
It's not that dark. It's not that dark. Everything tends to work itself out. And I think with Sanchez, you know, again, you know, none of these injuries that he's showing are, you know, the kind of, you know, career threatening or, you know, UCL shearing kind of deals. You know, these are all kind of smaller, more manageable injury issues. So hopefully he'll recover nicely from that, because as long as he's on the bump, he's going to be effective.
And I'm RJ Anderson, and that's Brian Gross Nihilistic, and that's our show for the week. So
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys. We are at DFA Podcast on Twitter, at DFA Podcast. And on behalf of RJ and Sean and myself, oh, we wanted to give a quick shout out to Kendall Gilmet, who developed a logo for the site and did all of our graphic design work. So thank you, Kendall. And as a result of that, you will be able to find us on iTunes shortly. We will work hard to get on Stitcher and some of these other podcast delivery sites as well. And also shout out to Emmett Rosenbaum, who's going to be our new social media consultant. He'll be the one who will help keep you in contact with the show and let you know what's going on minute by minute for the podcast. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.